a very good afternoon to you. The time is 12:07. This is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this Monday, October 8th. And with me in the studio, as he is most Mondays, it's Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Bob, thanks for being here with us once again.
Fine to be here. Thanks.
And there were silent rounds of applause in the rest of the studio here. Our other guests today, two fellows from IPFW who you may have heard before on our air. Joining us, it's Tom Hay once again. Tom, thanks very much for being here. And Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IPFW. They're raising the roof. Thanks very much for being here with us once again, guys.
Thanks, Sean.
We're doing our monthly political checkup, and of course, we want to hear from you today. What have you seen in the race that's piqued your interest or got you fired up? Let us know. Give us a call. The number is 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. Gentlemen, of course, you know, less than a month to go in the race here. Let's start big in terms of the race for the presidency of the United States. Tom Hay, where do you think the race stands now?
Well, Sean, I checked the Iowa political markets, which is kind of an interesting thing to look at once in a while right before I came in today. And it had gone from about 80% prediction factor for Obama to about 65% now in his favor. So the Iowa political markets still feel that President Obama is going to win. But that to me was confirmation of what I thought was pretty dramatic good news for the Romney campaign, which I don't think could have survived both a bad debate and bad news from the jobs numbers coming out. But it shows that the widely considered to be Romney victory in the first presidential debates has helped shore up some of the support that was leaving him. But if we still haven't seen a convergence between the national polls and some of the swing state polls, if you look at the swing state polls, it still looks more likely than not that Obama's ahead at this point.
And of course, the Romney campaign coming off what had been a difficult, really, really month with the 47% video, with a number of well-documented gaffes here. Overall, a big win for the campaign at the debate.
Sure, and the other number I would look for is how fundraising is affected by that, because that was where I have to assume the Romney campaign was really getting worried. Is when you've got people who have a lot of money and allocate it well, who hedge things for a living, you can certainly imagine that if they feel like there's no chance that they can pull this off, that you start to pull some of the resources. And the debate may have helped him there too. So you might want to see some of the most recent fundraising numbers and whether or not that's helped him and also the independent expenditure groups that'll be raising money to spend here at the last minute.
And Andy Downs, I want to move to you. Of course, one of the big pieces of news just out on Friday, the jobs numbers, as Tom mentioned, do you see that as a big boost for, say, the Obama campaign, which has really been struggling with the fact that the national unemployment number has been over 8% really since the start of his presidency?
It certainly has given him a good political line to use. Unemployment's at the lowest rate since I took office. You know, it makes it sound like the term is ending on a good note. And the reality is those sorts of bits of information are helpful, but we do have to ask, how do people on an everyday basis experience that, notice that? Do they experience it and notice it? Do they understand it? I know that if you walk up and ask people what is the unemployment rate, a large percentage of people have no idea what it is. But when you look at the folks who've spent their academic careers creating the models that predict election outcomes, unemployment numbers are one of the numbers they use. So whether we can name that number or not is somewhat irrelevant. We somehow feel it. And so if that number is indicative of a trend for the economy getting better, all the better for President Obama. If you look at instead of the Iowa numbers game, if you go to Real Clear Politics, by the way, I love Iowa. I think that's a great thing that they do. But if you go to Real Clear Politics, if you go to 270 to Win, if you go to a lot of the other places where they will break it down for you, what are solid, what are weak, what are toss-ups, we're basically talking about, depending on which group you're talking about, let's say 6 or 7 to 10, maybe 11 states that are in play here. And Obama is ahead in a pretty good number of them, and he has a large number of ways he can get to victory. So, you know, he's got to be pretty happy right now. The debate, I'm sure, did help Romney, and Tom's right. We got to look at those fundraising numbers and see what it did financially, not just for him, but all the PACs and 527s, et cetera. But in the end, it's still, you know, it's looking pretty good for the incumbent president, but certainly a little shot of life came to the Romney campaign last week.
Tom, hey, we have a caller on the line here. We'll get to John in just a moment, but I'd like to clarify, if you could, about what the Iowa markets are, and of course there are other markets available like InTrade, things like that as well. Could you just give us kind of a primer for our listeners?
They allow people to bet money on who they think is going to win, and so it's a betting line for politics, just like the point spread is for NFL fans, and allows you to see where kind of the masses are absorbing information or reacting to information, as opposed to some of the polls where you don't know exactly how the question was phrased, or you certainly have variations in different weeks in the poll. So these political markets are another interesting way to track things and see how people are responding. Another one I might bring in that affirms what Andy was saying is the Consumer Confidence Index, which had started to improve even before these jobs numbers for reasons nobody's quite sure about, because there wasn't anything specifically to make people start turning a corner on that, other than perhaps there's something going on in mass psychology out there that we just aren't quite sure of, that a lot of people have decided that, well, things are going to get better, or perhaps these are some people who have decided that they're going to vote for Obama and they have to convince themselves that that's going to be a good idea. We really don't know.
There are several economic indicators people look at when they're putting those models together. We've mentioned a couple here, but growth in the economy is another one. And usually the models that do this really well specify changes from one quarter to another quarter, say fourth quarter of last year to second quarter of this year. That's one of the margins that people look at. So for a lot of the people who put the models together, after the second quarter of 2012, they say, well, there you go, that's who's going to win. And they've been right a surprisingly large number of times. But this is, I think a lot of them would agree, an interesting year, because a lot of the indicators say that the incumbent should lose, except it doesn't look like at this point in time he will. It's certainly going to be close.
The election, of course, is less than a month away, and we are talking politics here on 89.1 FM. We want to hear questions from you, or perhaps comments from you, if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can send us a tweet. Let's go to John. John, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question, I can take the answer off the air. It's really short. Why has the Libertarian Party been completely locked out of the process, the debate, the media, and everything else, it seems? I'd love to hear your guest's response.
And,
thanks so much.
And John, very briefly, can you clarify for us just a little bit? Are you talking about across the board or in the national race specifically?
The national race. Gary Johnson, a good candidate, can't speak, and it sounds to me like the media doesn't give the Libertarian Party the time of day.
All right. Well, John, thank you very much for the call. We'll put that to our panel here.
Thank you.
All right. Have a very good day. We have heard a little bit of coverage on public radio and elsewhere from libertarians at various levels, but they're certainly not none of those candidates. Gary Johnson, anyway, is not appearing on the debate ticket.
Right. But in the gubernatorial race here in Indiana and the Senate race here in Indiana, we will hear from Rupert Bonham and from Andrew Horning. So, you know, depends on the race we're talking about. The poll results that came out a week or so ago from Howey and DePauw showed that Horning was actually pulling 7% in the Senate race, which is pretty good for a Libertarian at this stage in the process. There is a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy here in that You have to have some level of credibility before media will begin to give you a lot of coverage. But without a lot of coverage, it's hard to build up that credibility. If you don't raise much money, you can't raise much money. And so different entities have to think about how much space they have to fill, whether that's a 30-minute news program at the end of the day or so many column inches in print. And so they have to make a judgment, and they do that on a daily basis, and they do that based on what they in part think their readers are interested in and what they think are interesting stories that are compelling and for people to know about. And I'll point out that as far as our newspapers are concerned here, they do give a fair amount of coverage to libertarian candidates, although sometimes libertarian candidates haven't been so good about responding to questions.
That's happened, yes.
Yeah. The local newspapers do give pretty good coverage to them. And really, at that national level, the debate commission basically said, who do we think has a chance of winning? And they didn't think it was anyone other than the Republican and the Democrat. And that's where the line was drawn.
I think another thing to consider is that if you say, okay, we'll give this third party a seat at the national debate, well, do we give a fourth party and a fifth party a seat too? NPR tackled that in an interesting way last week when they had a mini debate on All Things Considered between, I think it was All Things Considered anyway, between Jill Stein from the Green Party and Gary Johnson, the Libertarian.
Mm-hmm. Tom, hey, I'd like you to weigh in on this as well. Is it fair to exclude, say, the Libertarian Party candidate from these national debates?
From the national debates, you have a real question of time. And I agree with Andy here that at the state level in Indiana, we've got a couple of interesting libertarian candidates that can be a factor in a couple of ways. And so attention is being paid to them. I was going to mention them when we got around to talking about them. But for people who watched the debates with me between President Obama and Governor Romney, they were frustrated at the limited number of issues that were covered. You know, some blame that on the moderator not tightening their responses a little bit, but they felt like there were major issues like gun control, it being in Denver, social issues, and some of the things that you mentioned before that had been dominating the news cycle the previous couple of weeks, and they may have wanted the candidates to respond to them, that they just didn't do. And if you had a third and a fourth party candidate there, you would split off 30% of the time or 50% of the time that you have in those debates. So you have to weigh whether you want to be fair to the third party candidates and fair in the sense that, yes, it's a circular argument here that you can't get any attention because you can't get on, and you can't get on because you don't have any support, with the desire to give the people who are tuning into the debate what they, many of them, want, which is a chance to see as much of these candidates as they can if they're undecided voters.
We're talking politics today on Midday Matters, and we do want to hear from you. It's just a bit less than a month away from the election. We want to hear what's piqued your interest so far. Give us a call or send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. Of course, that number, 260-452-1185. We're going to take a quick break. We'll keep the conversation going when we come back. This is Midday Matters.
My name is Katie Pruitt, and I like public radio. I like Diane Rehm because she tells guests to hush when they start to talk over each other. I like This American Life because, well, it's This American Life. But most of all, I like Fun Drive. It's a unique, unintentionally behind-the-scenes peek into WBOI. It reminds me that the thing I love, public radio, is happening just 10 minutes from my house. WBOI's Fall Fun Drive starts October 13th. Pledge early at nipr.fm, and thank you.
This week, we meet with two artful improvisers. Baylor Fleck joins us for a conversation about the banjo in bluegrass, jazz, and classical. Then we'll go for a jazz breakdown with New Orleans percussionist Jason Marsalis, plus music from Jerry Garcia, Patsy Cline, and Slim Gaylord. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Monday night at 7 on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne in fall 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum at www.indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Lutheran Hospital, providing procedures for heart failure patients that keep their treatment in Fort Wayne close to home. Information at LutheranHealth.net.
This is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this Monday edition of the program. With us in studio for the hour, it's Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, Andy Downs from the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IPFW, and Tom Hay, a professor at IPFW as well. And we do want to hear from you today. We are talking politics, and we want to hear what's piqued your interest, what you're looking ahead to in this last month of the campaign season. Give us a call. It's 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. And it looks like we have a caller on the line. Let's open the phones and go to James. James, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a question about the debates that we all watched. Romney pointed out a figure of almost $90 billion wasted on renewable energy, as far as Solyndra going bankrupt. I want to know how many, and I know it's trillions, if anyone can tell me on a scale, how many trillions of dollars of our own wealth have we transferred out of the country via petroleum by can we put that on a scale? It's like 1 to 2, whatever.
Oh my, that's a huge question. And gentlemen, I'm not sure we quite have that expertise in the room here. Guys, any thoughts on? I mean, kind of the scale of those energy investments.
Well, I don't have a good answer to that question other than to first make sure that people know about organizations like factcheck.org so they can go see, check on the accuracy of statements made during the debate and during stump speeches, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a lot of people who, when they talk about energy issues, want to talk about the, quote, real cost of oil and gasoline. And so they'll talk about the amount of money spent on defense when it comes to protecting and preserving peace in certain parts of the world as a way to help ensure that oil and gas will continue to flow to this country. So I don't have a good answer, but I know that people who are talking about it have a variety of ways. And it's not just investments like were brought up during the debate and investments like the caller mentioned, but additional costs on top of that are one of the things that people, or some of the things that people throw into that equation.
And a lot of people will also draw in some estimates of the cost of environmental damage as part of that total figure as well.
Yeah, I guess I would throw in that just this year, the United States went back to being a net exporter of petroleum as opposed to a net importer. Now, you're dealing with a commodity that's openly traded here. So what we spend on oil or what we spend on foreign oil, and I don't have good figures off the top of my head on that either, but there are a whole lot of questions about how you would measure what you're looking at versus these renewable energy things, investments, which are attempts to stimulate an industry as a form of industrial policy, in some cases to compete with other foreign industries, in some cases concerned about the future of the environment. But I wouldn't say that they're comparable things. You can certainly argue whether or not we've made the right investments in these companies, whether we've picked the right winners and losers, if you want to call it that, with these investments. But trying to spur growth in the renewable energy industry is really separate from the question of how much do we spend on fossil fuels, especially when you note that we actually profited from the fossil fuel industries of the country in the last year, which is new and not a lot of people know. A lot of people would assume that we're importing lots and lots of oil, where actually we've started exporting it because of some of the recent fines in the Dakotas, places like that.
Right. James, sorry we can't get a specific answer for you, but as Andy mentioned, PolitiFact and FactCheck .org typically check just about everything that that comes up in the debates. You may be able to get some additional context that way.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for your call, James. Of course, we want to hear from more of you this hour. The number 260-452-1185, or you can always call us toll free at 1-800-471-9264. Gentlemen, of course, only really a few weeks left here, about 4 weeks left until the big day. Lots of debates just on the national level still to go. Of course, this Thursday, one that a lot of people are looking forward to, the battle between Vice President Joe Biden and Republican VP candidate Paul Ryan. I'm curious, Tom, hey, what's your take on the Battle Royale this Thursday?
Well, I don't think I'll shock you by saying that vice presidential debates haven't been determinative in too many presidential elections, but they are a lot of fun. A couple of things here. Joe Biden's always an interesting figure when he gets out in public, and the Republicans, I was hearing on the way in, are already doing the expectations game by referring to Joe Biden as a great orator who is going to be difficult for Paul Ryan to match up with. And I'm not sure how many people have used that phrase before with Joe Biden. But Paul Ryan being there is interesting because I was challenging one of my colleagues at the debate. I said I'd give him $5 if he can find a Republican who likes Mitt Romney more than he likes Paul Ryan. That enthusiasm that Ryan has from the Republican base should make the attention on his performance, what he says. He's known to get into the details of budgets, could draw some attention to that more than maybe you would expect with a vice presidential debate. He's very, very popular with the Republican base.
And Andy Downs, vice presidential debates not necessarily determinative, but they draw an awful lot of people. I believe the 2008 VP debates drew something like 33 million television viewers, something like that. People do want to see what they have to say.
Well, I am shocked that Tom would say they're not determinative. You could knock me over with a feather when he said that. They really aren't. And part of the reason there was the excitement in 2008 was because you had the potential. First of all, you had a relative unknown in Sarah Palin, who some thought maybe couldn't debate, could debate. This was a chance to sort of see her her big debut on the national stage, not being able to just give a speech at a convention, but actually deal with somebody who was asking questions in a pointed fashion, and looking to see how well she could give and take with another person in this sort of high-profile way. But then, you know, Joe Biden is somebody who, when he does speak, perhaps he's been called a great orator because of the potential for gaffes that come out of his mouth, that it's great to watch because you don't really know what's going to happen. In this instance, I think there's still some of that in Paul Ryan. Yes, a lot of people say he's a wonk, he knows what he's talking about, therefore we should watch because it could be incredibly substantive. But this is really his first opportunity on this sort of stage. He has to be careful he doesn't upstage Romney, although I don't think he'll be able to do that in this particular setting. And then there are just some wild card factors in this one that makes it certainly less predictable than the one we watched last week.
Typically anyway, vice presidential candidates and vice presidents have more of the attack dog role on the campaign trail. So potential fireworks this Thursday.
We think about, go back an additional 4 years, and Dick Cheney played that role beautifully in terms of challenging the opponent. That was exactly what he was supposed to do. And as somebody who had no aspirations for higher office, he didn't have to hold back at all. And John Edwards, who clearly had aspirations for higher office, was not viewed as somebody who played the role particularly well of attacking and challenging. But in the end, they're all trying to manage the expectations. So, of course, they're going to say Joe Biden is an expert, and Democrats are going to say Paul Ryan, you know, knows so much. If he doesn't, you know, explain the world to us in 90 seconds, then he's failed. I mean, that sort of stuff's going to happen.
And I do want to mention briefly, you can hear all of the big debates right here on WBOI. That includes president, vice president, gubernatorial, and the senatorial debates. A last word on the national races here, and we'll switch to some of the Hoosier races that may be, frankly, a little more competitive in our state. Gentlemen, what does each campaign need to do in the last 4 weeks, up until November 6th? We'll start with you, Tom Hay.
Good question. well, the Obama campaign feels like they have to respond to what was seen as a lackluster performance in that debate. The sports analogy would be played prevent defense, it seemed, in that debate. And both his campaign and his supporters want to see him go score some points against Mitt Romney. And I don't think that they have any reticence to doing that. I there are a lot of reasons why you might explain Obama's performance there, but not many people think that's because he can't put it into another gear and push Romney a little harder than he did. The Romney campaign, of course, has a tougher challenge ahead. One of the things I guess I would point out that they're facing the fact that the Obama campaign has worked hard to define him in people's minds and have driven up his unfavorables quite a bit. And they tried to take the convention as an opportunity to personalize Romney, and they may not get another great shot at that. The debates proved that he's a very competent debater, but he's still got those issues where the Obama campaign's been defining him. The other is, we know that the Obama campaign can turn out the vote. We know that they can put in place the machinery to do that. And the Romney campaign, I think that's one of the things we'll be looking at with them in the next couple of weeks and months, is how well are they putting people on the ground in these swing states. And there was a story in the last week that in a couple of states where Republicans had outsourced some voter registration to a private firm, that the person who was running that firm had some problems in his background, and so they had to end that contract. And so you really don't want to be losing your voter registration drive in this last month in places where you can still register to vote. Time's running out quickly in Indiana for that. But that's one thing that I personally am looking for, is what kind of a ground game does the Romney campaign start rolling out? Can they put people out there doing the knocking on doors and calling people? And I think that the debate really saved that effort a lot, because when you're talking about a real marginal decision for people, whether they think it's worth it for them to help out for a couple of days knocking on doors, if they think their guy's going to lose and they're 100% certain of that, then they're not going to do it. This bucked them up a little bit.
Andy Downs, last word on the national race.
Well, I think Tom's right. If you look down in Florida, Romney had great crowds for events, and even if those were not new voters to him, if it simply was the loyal base deciding, yes, it's now worth my time to make those calls, that's vitally important. We've heard a lot of people recently talking about the ground game of the Bush campaign in 2004. You know, it's not enough to think your head. You have to actually get your people to go vote. But what I like to remind people is Election Day, depending on what state you're in, is as much as 30 days long now. So we start early voting today here in Indiana. So the ground game is not just about mobilizing the first Tuesday after the first Monday. It's about getting people in there now. Or in the next couple of days, depending on which state you're in, get them there now, because that vote is in your pocket then. It's one you can count on, and it's one less person you have to make sure gets there on Election Day.
We're talking about politics on today's edition of Midday Matters. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll switch to the Senate and gubernatorial races. And we do want to hear from you today. Give us a call. The number is 260-452-1185. Or you can always call us toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. Of course, you can always reach us on Facebook and Twitter. Whatever way you choose to do it, please make your voice heard today. We're going to take a quick break for the news. We'll be back. This is Midday Matters.
new nonpartisan primary system in California means two powerful Democrats will face each other this November, and Republican voters are scratching their heads.
I'm kind of up in the air. I like some things that both of them said, didn't like some things that both of them said. Tough decision. I'm going to have to study some more.
The bruising congressional battle in Los Angeles later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's weekdays starting at 4 on WBOI Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm Katie Anderson with WBOI News. A state health official says Indiana now has 8 cases of fungal meningitis linked to a tainted back pain medication, up from Saturday's 5 reported cases. State Department of Health spokesman Ken Severson also said in a Sunday morning statement that there have been no deaths in Indiana associated with the outbreak that spread to more than 90 people across 9 states and killed at least 7 people. The rare fungal meningitis cases are linked to a steroid produced by a specialty pharmacy in Massachusetts. That steroid has been recalled, and health officials have been scrambling to notify anyone who may have been injected with it. 6 Indiana health facilities received batches of the recalled steroid. The type of fungal meningitis involved in the outbreak is not contagious. With Indiana's gubernatorial candidates set to square off on their first debate Wednesday, Democrat John Gregg and Libertarian Rupert Bonham say they hope it's a chance for voters to learn more about them. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, neither says they need to come out of the debate a clear winner.
Several polls in recent weeks show John Gregg significantly trailing Republican Mike Pence, often by double-digit margins. Gregg says the debates offer him a chance to reach out to a key group of voters, moderate Republicans.
They'll find out that I am the only candidate that's had a record in Indiana and a record of bipartisan leadership. Nobody else can even say the word bipartisan and be truthful.
Gregg says his record of job creation is an issue he'll focus on. Pence's campaign refused to comment, but Pence has said his plan for job creation includes cutting personal income taxes, freezing new business regulations, and reforming the state's tax structure. Libertarian Rupert Bonham says when it comes to the debates, he's just happy to be invited.
No matter how much money we have collected, no matter how much campaigning or advertising we have purchased, we are all on an equal and level playing field.
Wednesday's debate in Zionsville, just north of Indianapolis, is the first of 3 between the gubernatorial hopefuls. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
Slowing enrollment at community colleges across the nation is sparking worries that efforts to increase the number of adults with college degrees will falter. WBOY's Will Murphy reports on how the numbers are playing out across Indiana.
Enrollment at Ivy Tech Community College is down 5% from last year. The Indianapolis Business Journal reports many community colleges nationwide are seeing enrollment declines of 3 to 5%. Experts say soaring tuition costs are largely to blame for the drop. Nearly every public college in Indiana has seen tuition and fees more than double since 2000. Ivy Tech's tuition and fees are up 74% since that time. Indiana Commissioner for Higher Education Teresa Lubber says the tuition increases aren't sustainable in an age in which many students base their college choices on cost. For WBOI News, I'm Will Murphy.
Authorities say no passengers on a South Shore commuter train suffered significant injuries when it struck an SUV at a northern Indiana crossing, killing the vehicle's driver. The train with about 200 passengers on board was traveling from Chicago when it collided with the SUV just west of South Bend Sunday night. Police say the train was going about 70 miles per hour when the crash happened, knocking the SUV several yards from the tracks and landing on its roof. St. Joseph County Police Sergeant William Redmond says investigators had no signs of malfunctions with the crossing's warning lights or gates. The identity of the driver who died wasn't immediately released. The South Shore train continued to the South Bend Airport station about 90 minutes late. And now back to Midday Matters with your host, Sean Beter.
Twenty minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, this is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. We're talking politics on today's Midday Matters, and with us in studio, of course, Bob Kaler, Andy Downs, and Tom Hay. We do want to hear from you today. Do give us a call, the number 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet at Midday Matters. Share your thoughts on this last month of campaign season. season with us this hour. We're going to move from the national races back home again to Indiana. And I want to start, gentlemen, with the gubernatorial race. Of course, you know, Mitch Daniels' term limited. The big race, of course, between, well, Mike Pence and John Gregg and Rupert Bonham. Andy Downs, I want to start with you. Your take on the state of the race 4 weeks out.
It, if we are to believe polls, and polls quite often are accurate, it does not look like it's much of a race at this point in time. Pence is enjoying a approximately 12-point lead over Gregg. He has a lead on him in terms of money. He's been able to get to this point by, I'm not sure, ever mentioning another opponent during this race. So he hasn't even had to do any of that stuff that a lot of candidates have to do in terms of drawing a contrast. The most recent polls show him up by not quite 50%, but 50% is within the margin of error. And, of course, Libertarian candidate will take, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5, maybe 6% of the vote. So he doesn't even need to get to 50% in order to win. The problem here that I see is that Gregg just took too long to get into the race. A lot of people thought that Pence had wonderful name recognition. So when he decided he was in, everybody thought this is a foregone conclusion. He was going to win. But his name recognition was great among those of us who follow politics. In the rest of the state, outside his congressional district, I don't know that it was really that great. And if Gregg had done, say, what Mitch Daniels did and get in early, spend time defining his opponent the way Mitch Daniels did, and he probably would be in a much, much closer race than he's in right now.
Tom Hay, I want to turn to you. I mean, obviously, you know, pretty much all of the polls we've seen are relatively wide between John Gregg and Mike Pence, who, of course, is leading. What can a campaign in this situation do to make up ground, if anything, at this level?
Well, they've got the debates coming up. So this would be...
Starting this week, in fact.
Yeah, starting this Wednesday. They can hope for two things. They can hope that John Gregg does really well, and they can hope that Rupert Bonham does really well. If the presumption is that the Libertarian candidate's usually drawing votes away from the Republicans, if Rupert Bonham has an unexpectedly good performance. We don't really know much about him. We didn't know much about Jesse Ventura before his unexpected victory in the governor's race in Minnesota. I'm not predicting that that's going to happen in terms of the third-party candidate winning. But nope. Third-party candidates have real opportunities in debates where people are tuning in that haven't seen them before. Gregg still has pretty good numbers in terms of his favorable versus unfavorable. But as Andy said, he simply hasn't been able to exploit that in any meaningful way. While you can see some things happening, or they can hope that a mistake is made by Mike Pence, while you can see some things happening, they certainly have a very, very steep hill to climb, and we'll need some luck.
We've got some callers on the line here. I do want to open the phones, and of course, if you want to share your thoughts with us today, it's 260-452-1185. Let's go to Dan on the line. Oh, looks like Dan has left us, unfortunately. Dan, if you'd like to give us a call back, we'll try to get you on the air here. Let's open the phones and go to Mary. Mary, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon. I have a question about voter suppression. How big of a wild card is it, and could it throw the election to Romney?
Let's go to you, Andy Downs.
Well, I was actually going to ask her to clarify whether that was on the state or national level. That's an interesting question, because we're seeing more and more stories about what people are calling are overt attempts to try and keep people out of the electorate. But at the same time, there are quite a few people who are fighting those things. So I think there's a level of awareness this election that there probably was not in 2008, 2004, and 2000. So in some respects, I think the effect might be lessened, with one small exception, and that is that there has been an increase in the amount of activity that people want to label as voter suppression. So, for example, voter ID laws. There were, I think it was 9 states last year, in 2012, that actually strengthened laws, voter ID laws they passed just the previous year. So there's a lot of activity in this way. in this area, but that's activity that's bringing it to the attention of folks. And so it might make a difference, but I think it's going to have to be a pretty close election for that to happen.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for your call, Mary. Of course, the big news within the last few weeks on that front is Pennsylvania putting their voter ID law aside until after the election. So, we are going to take a quick break. We'll talk about the big Senate race when we come back. Do stay with us. And, of course, if you'd like to offer your voice, the number, it's 260-452-1185. Stay with us. It's Midday Matters.
On Fresh Air, you can hear interviews that make you see the world in a new way.
Every drink of water you take, every pot of coffee you make is dinosaur pee because it's all been through the kidneys of a Tyrannosaurus rex or an Apatosaurus many, many times because all the water we have is all the water we have ever had.
You just never know what you'll learn next on Fresh Air. Join us.
Fresh Air weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
The Bible tells us God created man in his own image and started with Adam. Modern scientists, even many Christian ones, say
that would be against all the genomics evidence that we've assembled over the last 20 years.
I'm Neil Conan, Science and the Religious Divide over Adam and Eve. Plus one cellist's nightmare, Flying Coach. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
This is Jason Wilbur, guitarist for John Prine and host of the weekly radio series In Search of a Song. I'm proud to tell you that you can now hear In Search of a Song every Monday evening at 10 p.m. right here on Northeast Indiana Public Radio. Each week you can listen in as I talk with recording artists about the trials and revelations that have shaped their lives and their music. It's a fascinating journey, and I hope you'll join us as we go In Search of a Song.
Ten minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, it's Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. It's all politics on today's program, and we do want to hear from you. What are you looking for from the candidates in this last month before Election Day? The number 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. We're at Midday Matters. We've got another caller on the line. Let's open the phones and go to Tia. Tia, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question. We don't see a lot. I mean, we have seen historically a lot of fun third-party candidates, but my husband and I are both the Gary Johnson fans, and we wonder what it's going to take to get a third-party candidate to mean anything in a presidential election.
That's a big question. Tom Hay, of course, really the last time there was a major impact, I suppose you could say, of a third-party candidate, maybe 2000, maybe back to, say, 1992 with Ross Perot.
Yeah, money. It was what I would say. If you've got a candidate that comes from a third party that has the resources to compete with the other two parties in terms of advertising and organizing, you never know what could happen. Some of that could become easier with the internet. There was a group that was trying to get people on the ballot this year, and that didn't work out really for this year, but it could in the future. But it's what's really hard for third parties is the other two parties in our system, with the way our voting system is designed, are there to cannibalize anything that comes out of a third party. So Ross Perot was somewhat successful breaking through to people on the idea of balancing the budget. And both of the other parties took that issue away so that wasn't there for the Reform Party in the next election. So you would need to have a third-party candidate with resources, and then they would have to have the momentum to be able to take some issues as their own.
This does go back to the kind of difficult cycle we were talking about at the top of the program, Andy Downs, about, well, you need money to raise money. You need popularity to become more popular. It's a tough road ahead.
It really is. And for female candidates, they have something known as Emily's List. And for a lot of people, they think that's named after somebody. But Emily actually stands for Early Money Is Like Yeast. In other words, if you get the money early, you're able to raise money later on. Mm. So for third-party candidates or anyone other than the two major parties, so this could be independent candidates as well, money is an issue. Being able to take ownership of an issue, as Tom pointed out, is an issue. But we have to remember the laws are written by the two major parties, so they benefit from that. In addition to that, running for office is different than just about anything else that you've done. So if you've not run for office before and your first time running is on a statewide basis, let alone a national basis, you can be overwhelmed very quickly. And so what a lot of third parties need to do is get people in the pipeline, get them running for city council or county council and start working them up so that when they make their run for secretary of state or for governor, they are credible candidates and therefore able to move on at the next level.
Right. Or I could say, too, a serious crisis, which we're not wishing upon anybody, but the Syriza party displaced the PASOK party in Greece as the number two party because of the overwhelming displeasure with how the PASOK party was handling their financial problems. So some sort of serious crisis could give a third party an opportunity, too.
All right. Tia, thank you very much for the question and have a great day.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Just a few minutes left in the program, gentlemen, and we still haven't talked about what's probably the most competitive race in Indiana, and that, of course, is the Senate race between Joe Donnelly, between Andrew Horning, as was mentioned, and, of course, Richard Murdoch, who defeated Richard Lugar in the primary earlier this year. All polls indicate right now that I believe we're within the margin of error. Isn't that right, Andy Downs?
Yeah, virtually every poll that's been released publicly shows it within the margin of error. So this is something we know to be a very close race.
And even Donnelly's internal polling, of course, showed him, 3 points ahead of Murdoch, which is 3 points ahead, but still within the margin.
It's within the margin. That's what we always have to remember. We're talking about polls. There is that margin of error. So just because you're ahead by three, you remember you could also be down by a point or two, depending on the margin of error.
The state of this race at the moment, Tom Hay, as you see it, both men getting a lot of outside money to support television campaigns. Of course, both men getting around the state as much as they can. What's it going to take to win this race?
Well, I sound like I did before. It's going to take good turnout operations, and that's going to have some to do with the individual candidates' operations and some to do with how they're able to piggyback off of what the national campaigns are doing in the state. What we definitely see, though, there was an interesting thing that the Howie Politics folks put up this week, a bellwether index of social media. And what Richard Murdoch seems to be the unfortunate vehicle of every bad thing that's associated with Republicans right now, from Todd Akin's statements to statements he's made about repealing the 17th Amendment, which allows us to elect senators directly as opposed to have state legislatures do it. If the Twitter... This little model of Twitter they have is to be believed. Murdoch is really struggling against a tide of gaffes by various Republicans in the last few weeks. So for the Murdoch campaign, they sort of have to separate themselves from the negative things that swing voters are bringing to Republicans and sort of visiting upon him in an attempt to split the ticket is how I would say it.
Well, and Andy Downs, Murdoch came out of a very difficult race with Richard Lugar, which he ended up winning handily, but then he seemed to go into the general election with much the same, partisanship that we saw within the primaries, and that didn't necessarily play well with what some Democrats have called Lugar Republicans.
I'll point out that the Howie Politics DePaul poll from the before the primary showed that two-thirds of Republican primary voters, not the electorate in general, but Republican primary voters, wanted somebody who could work with the other side. And when, as we've seen in several commercials, when you say the enjoyment in politics is me inflicting my opinion on the other side, you don't sound like the person who's going to be cooperating with the other side. And Murdoch didn't so much win as Lugar lost. His campaign was not particularly good. A lot of people saw him as somebody who was ready to retire and move on. So, you know, that's part of the reason Murdoch made it out of that. And it's hard to run away from a statement like, I enjoy inflicting my opinion on other people, which makes it hard to look like you're going to work with the other side.
The interesting thing, of course, about this race, though, is that that was a seat that was pretty safely in Lugar's hands, you know, say a year ago, it seemed like.
If Lugar had won that primary, we wouldn't be talking about this as a close race.
A race at all. More than likely, he was a very long-term senator. Bob Kaler, I know you've been trying to jump in here all show, and I've been running you over.
Well, on the most pertinent thing we've been discussing here, why... do you think it was a good move for Donnelly to focus so strongly on this question of cooperation and to ignore what some other candidates facing Tea Party candidates have done, which is pick through their record and try to make them sound either kooky or spooky?
For one of the problems for Donnelly, though, is that Murdoch was a county commissioner and state treasurer. So picking through the record and finding those interesting votes and interesting quotes was going to be a little more difficult. As a county commissioner, you know, he's interested in making sure bridges are getting repaired and basic services are being taken care of. In fact, I've spoken with somebody from the Vandenberg County area who said she was just flat out shocked when she heard some of the things coming out of his mouth in the primary, because that's not how she perceived him when he was down in Vandenberg County. I also think that as a moderate, one of the ways to win was to attract people from the middle to his side. And people in the middle want to know somebody can cooperate with the other side. That's what the polling data shows. That's what history has shown us. So I think it was a pretty good move on his part. And I'm sure what he's hoping for and what we've seen is that other groups will go ahead and take up the cause of bringing up the unusual statements.
At the end of it all, as you mentioned, Tom Hay, it's all about get out the vote operations. From what we've seen from these candidates, do you think it's going to be close right down to the wire? And Andy, you can jump in here too if you like.
Sure, looks like it. We do have a little time for these advertising to heat up and get probably nastier than it's been so far, if you can believe that. But yeah, absolutely, it's going to come a lot to enthusiasm in these last few days of the race.
And since voting's already started, we know that it's going to be that way. The election board's already had plenty of people mailing in their absentee ballot applications. We can watch turnout there as an indication of how excited people are about this race. But I think Tom's right. This is going to come right down to the wire. And while the end result might be bigger than we're expecting right now, there will be excitement all the way to the end.
Tom Hay, Andy Downs, thank you both for being with us for this political check-in once again.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bob Kaler, thanks for being with us once again. We appreciate you being in the shotgun seat each week. I'm Sean Beter. Thanks very much to you all for listening, for calling in, and for sharing your thoughts. This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1, and streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOI Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock. Fresh Air is next.